a gay marriage ruling. Where do things go from here? Right to work goes to the Supreme Court. Do the unions have a chance? Jim Irsay punished the Secretary of Labor in Indianapolis, and Larry Bouchon delivers the GOP address. That plus the 50th anniversary of the Beatles at the state fairgrounds and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending September 5, 2014.
Programming is made possible by Ice Miller. Ice Miller, with a 100-year tradition of learning what is important to clients and strategizing with them toward a common goal. Today, Ice Miller continues its commitment to help clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
AT&T, working to enhance connectivity in Indiana by investing in communication networks. Dedicated to helping Hoosier businesses grow and consumers succeed both at home and at work. AT&T. Rethink possible.
This week, the Federal Appeals Court in Chicago upheld the ruling that Indiana's ban on same-sex marriages is unconstitutional. The ban was overturned in June when more than 800 gay couples in Indiana got married before a stay was issued. That stay is still in place, but plaintiffs in the case are celebrating. Here is lawyer Ken Falk, followed by plaintiff Rob McPherson.
And the answer the court here gives very forcefully is it hurts same-sex couples and their children, and Indiana and Wisconsin, not to allow this to happen, and it affords absolutely no benefit to bar these type of marriages, and it just makes no sense.
Our catchphrase for the longest time, and not only here in Indiana, but is love wins, and love won again today. That's all we've been asking for, and we've been validated that our family, who has loved each other for a long, long time, now has been validated by the court.
What is unusual about this ruling? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel, Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike McDaniel, John Schwannis, the host of Indiana Lawmakers, and John Ketzenberger, president of the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute. I'm Wish TV Statehouse reporter Jim Shella. Ann Delaney, this ruling came 9 days after a hearing with a three-day holiday weekend in the middle. What's that tell you?
Oh, it tells me that it wasn't just a 3-0. It was a 3-0 and we mean it kind of decision. And what's obviously the rapidity with which the opinion was issued is significant. But the other significant part is the scathing attack on the arguments made by Indiana. I mean, it's embarrassing for the state that they say there are so many holes in them you can drive trucks through them. They didn't say trucks, but they did say they had holes in the argument.
Well, it was a ruling written by Judge Posner, who is a Republican appointee.
Of Reagan, that's right.
Yeah.
But I think that his view on this and the arguments advanced by the state were an embarrassment. But his view on this, I think, is the view that is quickly becoming the prevailing view nationwide.
Attorney General Greg Zeller says that he will ask that this go to the Supreme Court. Should he give up at this point?
No, he should do what everybody said every step of the way, that the Supreme Court has got to make the final decision on this for the whole country, and they will. I expect that they'll take this up in the spring, and we'll have an answer next summer sometime. But to go back to your original question on this particular ruling, the speed of it was surprising, to say the least. I don't think anybody was surprised that it came down the way it did. But I was surprised a little bit at some of the verbiage in the opinion where Judge Posner referred to, made it sound like it was hate legislation that was being questioned here. This was passed in 1987 with overwhelming bipartisan support and signed by Governor Frank O'Bannon. Hate was not part of this process in 1987. What you have here is an issue that has evolved over a long period of time. So to refer to this in those kind of terms really kind of surprised me a little bit that the judge took that tact. But
It was 1997.
Or 97. I said 87.
Right.
But it was overwhelmingly supported by people on both sides of the aisle and signed by Governor O'Bannon. And this has never been about hate.
Well,
it's
a little about discrimination, that's for sure.
I think it's a little naive to suggest that there is not an undertone of hatred Now, Grant, I'm not saying that everybody who voted for this and that Frank O'Bannon, it was the conventional or the prevailing opinion at that point, but there is some real discriminatory, and I'm interpreting or offering the opinion, echoing what we read in the opinion from the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. Hatred may be strong, but probably not too strong. There are people, I'm sure, who feel disdain for people with alternative lifestyles.
Well, I'm sure there are people out there like that, but this was passed overwhelmingly with bipartisan support in 1997. So
yeah, there was no
attention to the evolution of this opinion.
But I don't think they were necessarily passing judgment on what happened. At that point, they were saying
that
the judges were saying that the arguments advanced the week prior.
Yeah.
And in the accompanying briefs were what was ridiculous and filled with holes. So I think there is a distinction. What I think the speed is clearly significant here, and this is now there have been in terms of federal judges. I think this is the 21st ruling that have all more or less landed with this on this side of the equation. Four of those now have been Court of Appeals.
Yeah,
and
that's the point. You don't need Indiana's appeal to get this in front of the Supreme Court. And if Greg Zeller persists in the appeal, it's for his political motivation.
No, that's wrong.
And not
he is
anything
doing
else.
What he said
he has already embarrassed
every
the state.
Every step of the way.
Greg
he
Zeller has already embarrassed
and
the state enough
wrong.
In Chicago.
He's doing exactly
do
what he's supposed
Washington.
To do.
Let's give John a chance here. have we crossed, crested the hill on this, as it were?
You mean as the issue in the whole and looking at it from the country's perspective? I do think it's very ripe for the Supreme Court to take the look at it. I would expect that it will happen either in the fall or the spring when they're considering their cases that it will come before the court. And it's very clear with both the rapidity, because Judge Posner had plenty of other cases to look at in this situation too, that the issues are becoming well-known and well understood. This was all about the Equal Protection Clause. He said that the law was discriminatory, and he said it very forcefully. He said it very clearly. And he also did note that in 1997, when that law was passed, he wasn't talking about hate, but he did note that it was passed again in 1997 because it was already law before, because there was fear that if Hawaii at the time was talking about legalizing gay marriage, there was he made some turn of phrase about homosexual Hoosiers hurrying off to Hawaii to get married, and he said the legislature was reacting to that, and he said it was pure discrimination, and he was right.
And if you want this notion, you asked the question about cresting the hill in terms of judicial opinion. I mentioned the 20 plus opinions on the one side beforehand. This decision, of course, got a lot of attention in the Seventh Circuit, but if you look at national attention, the federal decision that actually got more attention this week was the outlier, which came out of Louisiana, where you had the first, I think, of any of the federal rulings
that
basically upheld. Right.
Supported a ban.
But right. And the reason, news being that which is a departure from what is expected of the norm, it's interesting that now, a year or two ago, that would have been
the
norm. Now that's the outlier.
Right.
Which
a few
I think that answers your question.
The point is, the issue is going to the Supreme Court. It's going to the Supreme Court half a dozen different ways. There's nothing unique about our statute.
Right.
And so if they waste the time and effort trying to embarrass us again in Washington, it's because of Greg Zeller's political agenda.
That's just wrong.
The Indiana Supreme Court heard arguments this week on the constitutionality of Indiana's right-to-work law. The law says no one can be forced to join a union and was found unconstitutional by a Lake County judge. Union representatives who protested when the law was signed pointed to a statement by Justice Stephen David during the Supreme Court hearing. Here is Justice David, followed by David Fagan of the International Union of Operating Engineers.
Let's cut to the chase. This is certainly anti-union legislation, okay, or certainly not pro-union legislation.
I was impressed that finally someone in the public arena, such as Justice David today, said that this was an anti-union policy.
The Supreme Court issue is not the wisdom or policy that the legislature has decided. It's the constitutionality of that choice.
And that's Milton Chappell of the National Right to Work Foundation. Mike McDaniel, was Justice David's comment meaningful?
Well, I think you have to always evaluate what they're asking, and that tells you where they're what they're thinking, or at least it gives you an idea of where they think they might be going. So, I mean, it's always meaningful. I think at the end of the day, this one's going to be decided the way the federal court decided, that the legislature was clearly within their purview to do what they did.
Yeah, there was a ruling today from the federal appeals court, not today, this week, from the federal appeals court upholding the right to work law.
Yes, in a split decision in which Judge Wood wrote a scathing, I might add, dissent. The problem with the analysis of this is that Indiana has a constitution and Indiana has a Bill of Rights, and they're different from the federal constitution and the federal Bill of Rights.
This is all about the state constitution.
Well, it's all about the Indiana Bill of Rights, which Section 21 says you cannot force somebody to provide services without compensation, and you can't take property without compensation. We're not talking about forcing people to join unions. The vast majority of the money spent by unions is the grievance procedure. The federal courts have determined that unions have to represent everybody, whether they pay for that service or they don't. Okay? So you're then making the union represent them without compensation, and you're also making the union people who pay their dues pay more for that service. That, I believe, is unconstitutional under Indiana's law. And if it isn't, we should just repeal, because it doesn't mean anything.
But the fact of the matter is, what the justices are going to have to decide is a constitutional question and not a policy question, whether it's anti-union or not.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. I agree with Mike that you have to take into account what the justices ask and the way they frame their questions. And so it would seem to indicate that Justice David is looking at this from a policy or a pro or anti point of view. It very well may be a split decision, and I have no idea which way they're going to go on this, but it is clearly based on the issues that Ann talked about. It's a constitutional question whether or not that applies to a union, individuals, or only the state. And so that's what the question is going to have to get solved.
And with the federal court ruling, is this the last stand for the unions?
Last stand, no. It's not, because, in fact, you have another case. I mean, you're asking the big focus question.
Yes.
Let me get a little focus question here. There is another case coming out of that has come out of Lake County, another county judge that has invalidated the law and said it's unconstitutional. And there was an attempt to consolidate those two measures and have a single oral argument that was rejected, that attempt. So in theory, at least there will be an opportunity for the court to grapple with this again.
Well, you can certainly, this can be appealed. This isn't the final determination of that. So
it
can certainly, with an en banc hearing, or go ask for the Supreme Court. But if the section of the Bill of Rights doesn't have meaning, I don't know why we have a constitution. I mean, we pass right to work first. Then the federal government instituted the requirement of representation even for non-members. And now we have our Constitution and our Bill of Rights out there.
Justice Mark Massa suggested that maybe their issue should go to Congress to try to change the representation.
It's not a federal issue. We passed this knowing what the federal requirement is, okay? It's our problem.
I maybe misunderstood your question about if we're talking about the Indiana Supreme Court and the state constitutional question, I don't think there is a higher court.
They can't take that to the federal court.
Okay, so when
whether it's this case or the other case, the state Supreme Court is the last stand for the U.S.
Correct.
You could also have a taking under the Fifth Amendment of the federal constitution, which could be appealed from the Seventh Circuit.
Lawyer Full Employment Act. The NFL suspended Indianapolis Colts owner Jim Irsay for 6 games this week and fined him $500,000. The punishment came after Irsay pleaded guilty to 1 count of operating a vehicle while intoxicated. A 2nd charge involving possession of a controlled substance was dropped. Twice, prosecutors waited to announce developments in the case before holiday weekends, leading some to believe Irsay received preferential treatment. Deputy Prosecutor Andre Miksha.
I don't believe it would have that appearance. The plea agreement that was tendered had many of the same terms that most of our first-time OWI defendants have.
I do not believe there was preferential treatment. I think Mr. Irsay received the guilty plea agreement that one of my clients might receive, or that just about any other person charged with a similar offense.
And that's defense attorney Steve Stowes. John Ketzenberger, did Irsay receive preferential treatment?
I can't say. I don't know. I've never been in the courts in Hamilton County. But I will disagree with the prosecutor by doing the timing that they did, by doing it ahead of weekends where there were...
First Memorial Day weekend, then Labor Day weekend.
They certainly raised that question in a lot of people's minds, and I think it's a fair question. They did the defendant in this case, Jim Irsay, no favors by creating that kind of perception. And they certainly don't do the citizens of Indiana any favors by allowing it to linger.
Some people think that the $500,000 fine from the NFL, while it's substantial, is less than a player would get. If a player was suspended for six games, many of them make more money than that.
True. If you look at the Wes Welker scenario, on the same day, in fact, Broncos receiver was suspended for a period of time, and if you look at what the impact would be under the collective bargaining agreement, it's $1.8 million hit as opposed to $500,000, which, as I understand it, was the maximum for an owner or a front office a member of the front office staff that the commissioner could render. In some ways, though, I think we talked about the timing in terms of the criminal case. I think he might have been at a disadvantage, Jim Irsay, in terms of the timing with the NFL, because these don't happen very often where you have owners. I think 1999 was the last time maybe Eddie DeBartolo Jr. in an extortion case faced significant sanctions. So these don't come up very often, so it's hard to say what the norm is. But it comes on the heels of the Ray Rice brouhaha where a player domestic violence case where the commissioner acknowledged he got it wrong. He seemed to be giving somebody a slap on the wrist. So I think in the wake of that and the policy recalculation that had been issued just a week or so ago from the NFL that we're going to basically be a lot tougher on that issue,
right.
I think Jim Irsay had the misfortune, if you want to call it that, of coming on the heels of that.
Irsay issued a statement saying that he hopes that this can eventually be seen as a positive event. How likely is that?
Well, I hope it is for him. I mean, I hope that he gets the help he needs and turns his life around from this addiction to these painkillers, because that's a terrible way to have to exist. But to Jim Irsay, the fine, regardless of the amount, was not going to be as severe as the six games. The six games for a guy like that, who lives and breathes this football team that he owns, is torture for him. And I think John's right. I think coming off the domestic violence debacle that the NFL messed up, that he got the six games is pretty severe. I thought the fine was a slap on the wrist at best, but hopefully he'll get the help he needs, and this will be a positive event for him going forward.
What about the court treatment?
You mean
dismissing the felony charges?
I think that's probably pretty common in this. The object on this with the addiction to that kind of a substance would be to get him help, generally speaking. So it's not uncommon on a plea bargain for that to happen. And, you know, maybe it fit half a million slap on the wrist. For some other people, it might be devastating, but I think the public humiliation here, whether it came before the weekend or not, everybody in central Indiana knew he'd been arrested and pled guilty. And I think that's a pretty substantial punishment.
I think one of the things that you talked about, the plea agreements, those happen every day in every court in every county in the state. It's just that when it becomes a high-profile case like this that people pay attention, they think, well, why is he getting off? Why is he getting lighter treatment? Those kinds of pleas are made all the time with all kinds of people.
Well, but the question is, we have limited numbers of jail beds in prison, and what do you save it for? If you can get them help, which is a big if, but if you can get them help and stop the conduct, you're much better off than taking a bed from someone who's a violent felon.
Regardless of whether it's Jim Irsay or Joe Smith.
Exactly, and that's usually the way it happens. It's just that nobody pays attention to Joe Smith.
Right.
Time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question, did Jim Irsay deserve more punishment? Your choices are A, yes, or B, no. Last week's question, should Evan Bayh run for governor? 56% said yes, 26% said no, 18% said it's up to him. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to WFYI.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Pike High School was recently awarded a $7 million federal grant to help develop job training programs. This week, Labor Secretary Thomas Perez paid a visit to Pike to see how the money's being spent. Senator Joe Donnelly and Congressman Andre Carson came along. They toured classrooms and took part in a roundtable discussion. Pike was awarded the grant because it has a high poverty rate and a high graduation rate. Secretary Perez.
And if you figure out the right ways to draw out those gifts and talents, everybody gets to punch their ticket to the middle class.
John Schwanes, how unusual is Pike High School's approach to job training?
I think it's becoming more common, and I think that's really the idea behind these grants. It's to identify and nurture best practice. And if 24 grants nationwide is defined as rare, well, then I'd say it is somewhat rare. But this was one of 24. It's, I think,
it's also the biggest amount that was given.
One of the biggest, if not the biggest. So let's put it this way: if it's rare now, it won't be rare soon because other schools will see, hey, somebody else got $7 million. How fast can I adopt those programs and practices? And I think, again, that's what this program is designed to do, is to recognize and reward people who do it right.
65% poverty level, 93% graduation rate.
That's incredible success and shows that it can be done. Every school district and all of the makeup and the demographics are different. I think when we lump everything together is when we get into trouble. But there are certainly lessons that can be learned and applied in various school districts, and hopefully that's what's going on here, because I think sometimes we overthink education. It's like, figure out who your students are, what it is that they need, and help them get that. And if this can do that, then terrific.
And have teachers who can help them.
That's exactly
right.
Which
means training.
You
don't have to just put anybody in the classroom. The 93% graduation rate's remarkable. What the other remarkable factor is more than 80% of the students there are minorities. And you've got a public school system that is doing the job correctly. At the same time, we're having charter schools left and right fail or abandon themselves, or even the supervision of Broad River High School's over. I mean, the whole charter thing is imploding, and yet you've got a public school here that is doing a very noteworthy, nationwide noteworthy job. It's great.
Did you know who the Secretary of Labor was?
No, but this is a great story. And this is consistent with what's going on around the country now. We had bipartisan support for legislation here in Indiana that would match up business community with school systems to try to help give students the training that they need. That's what's going on here. And I think that's important because people are realizing that we need to start teaching young people to be prepared for the workforce. And that's what's going on. And this is a great, great program.
Ivy Tech's involved there, too.
And obviously, Senator Donnelly and Representative Carson did a great job bringing that money home.
It's hard to argue. 50th anniversary of quite possibly the biggest day in the Indiana State Fair history was marked this week. September 3rd, 1964, the Beatles entertained 30,000 people right here in the grandstands in two sold-out shows. One of them, I guess, was in the Coliseum. The only Beatles concerts ever held in Indiana. Tickets were $5 or less. Three brothers, Bill, James, and Mike Yarber, were at the concert and decided to make it a point to come together and remember that day.
Girls screamed at everything. They come out there and straighten up an instrument, and they would scream, or do something with an amp and scream. Car would pull up back here, they would scream.
It's a great kind of a memory, a special memory to have, particularly with all three of us going.
Mike McDaniel, you were there.
I was there for the night concert. I'm not sure my dad knew what he was buying when he bought those tickets. I was 13 years old, and it was a great event, something I'll never forget. The Beatles changed music history forever. I mean, every group, local group that were playing Beach Boys music, like local groups like the Chancemen and all those groups, all of a sudden overnight are doing the British Invasion and trying to do Beatles song. They transformed rock and roll music forever.
I have one question, though. Did you scream?
No, but my sister sure did.
You went to the Coliseum show?
No, I was in the grandstand that night.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And tickets were $3, $4, and $5. And they made $86,000 on their two performances that day.
Wow. Now, that was big money back then.
That was big money.
You still go to concerts.
I do a lot, yeah. But I'm going to see Johnny Mathis next month.
You're
going to
pay more than $3.
I paid $2.75 to see Paul McCartney 6 months ago.
$2.75. No.
Times have changed. That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike McDaniel, John Schwanes of Indiana Lawmakers, and John Ketzenberger of the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity or Bright House Networks. I'm Jim Shello of Wish TV. We'll see you again next week.
Programming is made possible by Ice Miller. Ice Miller, with a 100-year tradition of learning what is important to clients and strategizing with them toward a common goal. Today, Ice Miller continues its commitment to help clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
AT&T, working to enhance connectivity in Indiana by investing in communication networks. Dedicated to helping Hoosier businesses grow and consumers succeed both at home and at work. AT&T. Rethink possible.